Some say this is the blind and ruthless inevitability of progress. Matrices multiplying, transformers transforming, learning, evolving, accelerating. It promises miracles, whispers threats. Will the revolution be vibe-coded? Forget the hype. What's really happening under the hood? We're finding out. This is the acceleration. Welcome back to the acceleration, where we explore the frontiers of AI and the innovators turning big ideas into real-world tools. I'm your host, Avi Burra. Today, for our third episode, we're joined by Jim Carucci, founder and CEO of Cascada, a company on a mission to reinvent how we interact with information using AI and Bitcoin. Jim's journey is anything but ordinary. From NCAA Division I wrestling to leading R&D teams at Fortune 500 companies, he's now building open-source, privacy-focused AI products that just work. At Cascada, Jim and his team are pioneering everything from lightning-fast podcast search engines to AI assistants that streamline complex legal workflows, all while championing user privacy and decentralization. We'll dig into how AI and Bitcoin can empower individuals and what it takes to build practical tools in a crowded field and why small focus teams might hold the keys to the next wave of innovation. Get ready for a conversation at the intersection of engineering grit, product vision, and the future of AI. Let's jump in. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thanks, Avi. I appreciate the kind intro.
Did I get the pronunciation right?
You did get it right. That was perfect. And my name was correct. Some people messed that up too. So,
great. Because your company is spelled CASCDR.
That's right.
Yeah. Cascader it is. So, Jim, you have an interesting backstory. You were in NCAA Division I wrestling. And now you're leading. And then you went on to lead R&D at Fortune 500 companies. And now you're building AI tools at your own company, Cascada. What was that journey like?
Well, it was very eclectic, I would say. And so that's kind of, I think, one of the things that makes me a bit unique, right, is I've had a versatile experience in a lot of different fields. I studied electrical engineering and Asian studies with a focus in Chinese, actually, in college while I was competing. And it really taught me how to really appreciate different fields of study, how to learn quickly and how to, apply them to complex problems once I got into the workforce. So that experience was incredibly valuable in just being around other people that pursue excellence and, are kind enough to share their wisdom with me. Both in terms of, when I competed, there's guys that were my teammates that were in the Olympics this cycle. And there were also tons of mentors along the way. I had professors that were Bell Labs employees. So if anybody knows what Bell Labs is, they were responsible for inventing the transistor. And so they were, heavyweights in terms of research and development. I learned a lot from one of my professors there. Had tons of professors that were entrepreneurs, independently wealthy, don't need the paycheck, coming back just to give back. Because they're alumni, so I had great professors that would teach you about, the hardcore physics and engineering that you need to know, but also the business savvy and other stuff like that. And then took that experience, went into the workforce, worked for some great companies, had some great mentors once again, and parlayed that into my entrepreneurial, mindset into trying to do things like Cascader.
NCAA Division I is no joke. I have a high school age son, and he's 14, so he's a junior, he's a freshman, and he's training to be a pro soccer player, or he wants to be a pro soccer player. He's on his varsity team, And, you know, this, and we're looking at all the divisions that are available and how competitive each of them are. How did that, I'm still curious, Jim, like, you know, that you have to be absolutely like laser focused, right? To be a Division One athlete, that has to be your life. And then to be able to switch contexts into R&D and electrical engineering and what have you, that must have been quite a, obviously, one of them, your wrestling career must have suffered as a result.
Well, that's a great point. I mean, wrestling's a pretty brutal sport in general, not just from a physical standpoint and like on the mat, but off the mat. You have to be controlling your weight. You have to be very disciplined in that respect. And, you know, I wouldn't say my wrestling suffered per se. I mean, I was there to get an education, and the school I chose, you know, it was number 8 in the country. It wasn't because of me. I had a lot of teammates that were much more skilled than me. I would say just coming out of high school, I was what would be considered a late bloomer. If you don't start when you're 5, you're pretty much a late bloomer by default. That's the way the sport works. But I grew fast. I had some natural talent, and I was sort of like a Tom Brady type pick. So there were other guys that were, you know, clearly phenomenal wrestlers that came to my school. We actually had the number one recruiting school in the country my year that I was I came in, but I was sort of more like the, you know, 6th or 7th round draft pick. I was scrappy. I had a lot of potential. You know, the coaches took me under their wing, but it wasn't like I was a world beater off rip. And you know, that process of, as you said, switching contexts, I was dual major. You know, it was sort of like Renaissance man training. I really do believe in being versatile, especially in this world where we're talking about AI, you know, potentially taking out some of these really, you know, established, you know, fields that take, you know, decades to establish. You know, it's possible that AI starts to erode that. So I think, you know, the AI age could very well be the age of the Renaissance man. So I'm grateful to have, as I said, all the great people around me that helped coach me and teach me and help me kind of develop this, I don't want to say jack of all trades, but this versatile approach that I have.
And I do want to talk about that when we get to your work in Cascada, Jim. But there was obviously a time in the corporate world before that, right, between wrestling and Cascada, where you said you were working at Fortune 500 companies, or was it consulting with them?
No, I worked for them. I was a full-time employee. So I came out of school. I actually forewent my Asian studies degree, much to the chagrin of my parents, because I wouldn't need to go to school for an extra year. But I kind of caught the bug my senior year of hands-on experience. I kind of got the "you can just do things" meme in real time, mm-hmm. as I did senior design lab. So that's effectively an entrepreneurial course. It was taught by the most entrepreneurial professor we had, and effectively you had to build a business over 2 semesters with one partner. And so we actually won the most outstanding design award from that. And that really got me jazzed about starting from zero and trying to make something. And so I got a really great job offer from a great company in the area from where I went to school that is still family owned. And so that taught me a lot about low time preference and rigor on the scientific method. I learned a lot about manufacturing. I learned a lot about working in international teams. So I actually got sent to Mexico for that. You know, this company, I learned a lot about low time preference because they were not publicly traded. They had the opportunity to kind of think in the long run because they were, you know, the guy that founded the company invented some pretty pivotal technology that he refused to sell to GE. Instead of selling out to GE, he kind of used his patent window in order to build up a company and then start going higher end so that he was ready for that. And that's a pretty incredible approach. Mm-hmm. Now, the interesting thing about being low time preference like that is when you're a young buck, when you're 24 years old, you don't fully appreciate that and you start looking for adventure. And so I went to a much bigger company that is publicly traded, and is much more aggressive on R&D. So I and they're much more high time preference. So I learned a lot about just from that contrast, low and high time preference. I didn't really have a word for it at the time. I didn't know, you know, this Austrian economics term, which, you know, basically frames, you know, how long term are you thinking? What is, you know, what is the frame of you know, the window of thinking that you're applying? But I went to a higher time preference business, but at the same time, it was much more dynamic. So I got exposed to even more dynamism. And as I've said, you know, versatility and dynamism has kind of been, you know, a key theme throughout my experience. And that has, that experience was incredibly valuable as well. And I had numerous mentors at that job that really helped me grow this company that I worked at. It's one of the bigger power tool manufacturers in the world. And I just learned a lot about, you know, how to really swing for the fences, how to build on timelines, how to go from zero all the way to Home Depot shelves, and how to, you know, how to navigate a large organization like that. So I'm the type of person, I don't really regret anything. I appreciate deeply both of those experiences and the diverse experiences and how they've kind of influenced me to where I'm at now.
Was there a single aha moment, Jim, that led you to say, you know what, it's time to move on from the corporate world into something that I'm building by myself?
Yeah. For me, there was one, I'll say it's a singular experience. You know, I made a breakthrough that I, you know, was mostly self-directed. There were certainly some people that helped me around the side, but I made a contribution that I would estimate is in the hundreds of millions of dollars range. And, I kind of just got a pat on the head. And so that's when you get into, you know, you realize that's when you get into, realizing, you know, how a lot of corporate America is, you know, it can be communistic in some ways. It can be very, you know, middleman centric. And, that kind of got the wheels turning on me of like, I can't stay here forever. And it kind of made me realize that even if I'm doing something really wholesome and, you know, on the surface virtuous, like, you know, helping build construction tools, right? Like making those better, you know, fiat corrupts everything. The incentives are corrupting everything. And I needed a change.
Well, that's great. So tell us then, Jim, about Cascader. What are you building there?
Yeah, Cascader, we started this project. It started at TabConf 2023. For those of you that don't know, that's one of the bigger Bitcoin conferences. And we basically started with the question, you know, can we make ChatGPT sessions and other type of API sessions, can we make those Bitcoin payable and discoverable over Nostr? And in so doing, you know, we created sort of a prototype that lets you pay in Bitcoin and remain anonymous while still benefiting from these services. And, you know, that really opens up, you know, numerous advantages that I won't get into here. So it started with that question. And then, you know, I got into thinking even more, what would it be like if you could chain together different APIs to achieve a certain outcome? And so that's where the word cascader comes from. A cascaded system in electrical engineering is when you take one circuit and feed it into the next circuit and then feed it into the next circuit in order to get a given effect. So a good example might be a guitar amplifier, where you have numerous stages that all feed together, and then maybe you even have a whammy bar or something that adds a little zest at the end. So I actually, the first prototype of Cascader was it's still up, but it was like a workflow builder. But what I came to realize was, that type of interface and, you know, the Zapier like interface is not going to exist for much longer, because the clip at which AI is evolving, the AI is figuring out at runtime how to select the correct tools. So I started getting religion on, you know, agents and what they're capable of and actually implementing them in, you know, meaningful applications. So I wouldn't say I pivoted per se, because I always knew I just wanted to be at the pioneering edge, the bleeding edge of AI and Bitcoin. But I started figuring out, you know, how do I actually create value in meaningful ways in applications that are, you know, higher margin.
So is Cascada a suite of products, or is it a single product?
Yeah, it's evolved into a suite of products. So the initial page, cascader.xyz, it has a bunch of examples. It has a bunch of, like, I'll say, you know, paid API endpoints. A lot of them have user interfaces where you can interact with them one-on-one. But we also have products such as pullthatupjamie.ai, which uses, you know, a confluence of those APIs in order to really do things that are along the lines of what would it be like to have Jamie Vernon, like an automated version of Jamie Vernon from Joe Rogan. So it's able to find podcast clips fast. It's able to search the web fast with a Perplexity-like experience, and you're able to make clips, surface clips, make suggestions, share them very quickly. So we use state-of-the-art AI techniques to do those.
So let's take an example here. You and I are talking, and then you say something that is so completely outlandish that I'm like, hold on a second. So I open a new tab with the pull.upjamie app, right? And I try to pull up podcast clips. I search for podcast clips that kind of, are the counterpoint to your statement. Is that how it would work?
Yeah, you could do that. You know, a lot of people use them for promotion. A lot of people use them for looking things up in real time. Like the guys over on Stacker News Live use it, especially the web search function. Because that is a lot of, you know, what Pull That Up Jamie is about is kind of double checking, facts. But yeah, also you could actually pull the receipts on a particular conversation and figure out what somebody actually said in real time.
How does it do that? Does it get the transcript?
Yeah, so we pull the transcript. This is all open source, by the way. We pull the transcripts, and then we calculate embeddings. So for those of you that don't know, an embedding is a mathematical representation of the meaning of words, or it could really be abstract. It could be the shape of an image of an object. But the concept is that you basically create what are called vectors or mathematical representations of speech or meaning. So we take the transcripts, we chunk them, we embed them, we store them in a database, and then when you look them up at runtime, we find them. And the advantage of that is, number one, it's very fast because computers understand math and vectors very easily. And the second is that it doesn't require you to use the exact terminology. It's what's called semantic search. So if you said, you know, a canine, wearing a crown, you could also look up a dog dressed like a king. You know, you could get the same gist of meaning and end up getting the same result. And so that's useful when, you know, a lot of the use cases are you listened to a podcast a long time ago, you forgot exactly the way they worded it, but you know generally what you're looking for, and you're able to find it very fast.
So do you pull the transcripts from the APIs that the podcasting apps provide? Because I'll give you the reason why I'm asking this, Jim. One of the things I've been meaning to do in the last 2 weeks or so is I have another podcast called Blepchain Radio, which has been running for 2 years. And the Fountain podcasting app recently released a really cool feature where they do AI summaries, right? They obviously you could always get a transcript from Fountain. They've had that for a couple of years now. But now it takes that transcript and, you know, I don't know what it uses at the back end, Claude or whatever it is, right? And it makes it a really nice human-readable summary, unlike a transcript which can get incredibly long. And I was thinking that wouldn't it be really cool if Fountain had an API that was exposed to the public where we could call... I mean, we would obviously pay for the compute, but I'd be able to call all my 110-odd episodes that we've recorded over the last 2 years for Blepchain Radio, pull the transcripts and then have a really nice page where I, you know, where I have the episode. You can listen to it, but you can also read the summary, right? And also, it just the word about the knowledge base about my other podcasts kind of spreads into the internet just by existing in written form. But that was, I wasn't able to do it because Fountain doesn't provide an API. So would one of the tools that you're building be able to solve that type of problem?
Yeah. So the way we work is we index only a specific subset. It can get very expensive very fast if you do every single thing under the sun. We picked the top podcast that we thought a Bitcoiner would want just because that's our core audience right now. But we also picked a few mainstream podcasts like Joe Rogan Experience. I did Latent Space, which is kind of more specific than that. That's about AI. But I did some Bloomberg podcasts. I did Young Turks, just to get a diversity of ideas in there and things that you can search in there. So the way it would work is, yeah, you would come to us, and so we have a product, it's called Jamie Pro. If you come to us, we'll index, you know, your last, last 10 to 20 hours of podcasting, and then that will be searchable. So it'll be a tool for your internal team. It'll also help you get discovered by, you know, people that are kind of in this audience. And then, as you stated, once we have the transcript, we can do a lot with it. We can do things like what you described, which is basically iterating over the knowledge base, the embeddings, and being able to answer questions and or make content or explore the subject matter more deeply. That's very much possible with what we're doing.
Do you use Whisper to transcribe?
No, I use an API called DeepGram, which tends to be higher accuracy in my experience.
Oh, that's interesting.
And they have time stamping down to the word, down to the sentence, or down to the paragraph, depending on how you want to do it.
Love it. All right, so you talked about the Jamie Pro, or pull that up, Jamie, right? The two products. What else? Is there anything else in Cascada that you're building?
Yeah, so just finishing, rounding out Jamie Pro. I didn't completely finish explaining that. So if you come to us, you get on Jamie Pro. We will index your last, 10 to 20 hours of podcasts, and then we will also run the Jamie Pro agent on that, which will look at your preferences. So you can give it your preferences of the types of topics that you follow, and then every time you drop a podcast, it'll send you an email that has, some candidates for clips for you to post to social media.
Great. And is this live? Like, I can go and purchase use Bitcoin and get my podcast indexed using this tool?
So you can search using Bitcoin, and you can do a bunch of things using Bitcoin, including making clips and such. But in order to be on Jamie Pro, you do have to pay with fiat because we need a subscription model. But if you were to go to pull that up, jamie.ai, request a podcast, and then go through the wizard there of letting us know what you want to index, then we'll set it up, and it's $50 a month.
Interesting. So let's talk about that for a second. The pay as you go, using Bitcoin per compute request versus a subscription. Did you run the math on both those models to see which one actually made more sense from your perspective?
Well, I very much value Bitcoin and pioneering what's possible with Bitcoin. I think there's a bunch of different benefits of using Lightning. I think the number one is probably privacy, just because due to superb sender privacy with Bolt 11, you get you can remain anonymous while using our service. So that's something we value a lot, is privacy. So that's one big reason. The other advantage is that anyone anywhere in the world can use this, regardless of whether they can get access to a credit card. So that's awesome. The third hidden benefit of that is, as we move towards a system where you have sort of a machine payable web, you have agents that are kind of set loose on the internet, Bitcoin can kind of be the glue that holds all of that together. So you can give an, you can imagine a future where you give an agent a Bitcoin budget, and then it's able to accomplish a bunch of things for you, including, you know, getting clips for you for your podcast. So that, that would be an example of why it's advantageous. That said, just in general, and this is not just with us, but with many, a lot of people don't necessarily want to spend their Bitcoin. So I would be psyched if tomorrow we were hyper Bitcoinized and all we did was transact in Bitcoin, but we are a business, so we have to adapt to, you know, practical limitations there.
Yeah. But let's play that scenario out, right? I mean, I'd look, if I was earning in Bitcoin, I'd spend my Bitcoin too. And I try to support as many Bitcoin merchants as I can, just to keep the grease, keep the circular economy as greased as possible, given most people's, I guess, their instinct to hold Bitcoin rather than to spend it. But I think we won't have a circular economy unless people actually spend Bitcoin, right, on goods and services.
Yeah, that's very noble of you. And actually, this is a topic I'm very passionate about. And I know you said this wasn't a Bitcoin podcast, but here we go. You know, there's a lot of people I respect a lot. People like Chris Guida, who's a Core Lightning dev, and Wes from Tampa Bay Bitcoiners. We're very passionate about making sure that medium of exchange proliferates, and we understand there's UX and other limitations, but I really think, you know, if you want to claim the mantle of Bitcoin maximalist and somebody offers the opportunity to pay in Bitcoin, you really ought to pay in Bitcoin, just because that, as you said, that keeps the gears lubricated for the Bitcoin economy. And I think that's going to be needed more than people think.
So let's bring that back to AI agents. You set them a budget, but beyond that, though, or before that even, Jim, let's say I want to use Claude. I love Claude. How do I buy API credits for Bitcoin? I mean, is something like that going to change anytime soon?
Yeah, I think as of right now, you're kind of constrained by, you know, Anthropic's personal, you know, ideals, which, you know, my understanding is they're probably not pro Bitcoin. So you're going to have to have essentially a middleman, that would, you know, proxy your request through their API and give you essentially the same experience. I think that's not only is it possible, we've done it. I've known many others have done it, but it's there. I think that in the long run, it's going to have to evolve into open source. I think that basically we're kind of reliving a very similar scenario to the early internet, where you had Microsoft try to create a closed, you know, Microsoft internet with their browser. That ultimately failed just because open source is far too powerful. As Mark Andreessen says, you know, all of the smart people in the world versus, you know, a few hundred smart people in the world working for you. They're going to win every time. So I think I'm incredibly encouraged by what I see from the open source community. And I think that's a critical pillar for ensuring that we have a future with liberty, because without that, you could easily see there being a lot of haves and have nots that, and having the haves hoard that information, hoard that access, censor what information you can get, censor what questions you can ask. So that's a big part of, you know, why I became so excited about Cascade, about using Bitcoin for economic coordination and liberty in this new AI future, where, you know, there's a real threat of monolithic AI taking your liberty and your wealth.
100%. You know, it's interesting, Jim, to hear, and this was, when did DeepSeek R1 come out? Sometime mid-January, right?
Yeah.
And the amount of crying we heard from the OpenAI folks, even folks in the U.S. government, the new crypto czar or whatever, right? Crying that China is stealing, but they distilled these precious U.S. models. You know, let's specifically talk about ChatGPT and OpenAI. They stole our knowledge base, right? They trained their models on us. And you know, I don't think they get to complain that someone else is distilling their models to build an open... First of all, DeepSeek R1, I mean, yes, you can... There are concerns around censorship and how much of a stranglehold the CCP has on it. But just set, if you set that aside for a second, it's an open source model, right? And there are American companies who have now taken that, running it. They've changed the weights so that the censorship is gone. And now they're running locally hosted, US hosted instances of that. But do you see that irony as well, that you have these, as you said, these monolithic corporate AI, closed source corporate AI companies who trained their models on our collective knowledge base and wisdom, right? They, through tweets or through blogs or whatever it is, the irony of them turning around and saying their models were distilled and complaining about that.
Yeah, this is an old playbook, and I've already done it, and I love bringing things back to historical examples, just because when you're running into something unprecedented, I think it's good to reflect on human nature. This is robber barons 2.0, right? So they're trying to corner the market on this new gold mine. And as you point out, I'm incredibly grateful for open source. So my three takeaways from that are, you know, the Chinese are definitely distilling. You know, you can see that in the evidence that sometimes DeepSeek thinks it's ChatGPT, which is hilarious. The second is that, you know, American tech bros are getting blown out and they're probably resting on their laurels. So that's one of the big downsides of cartels and monopolies. And then the third is, thank God for open source. And as you pointed out, for all its flaws, you know, I'm running my own DeepSeek in the cloud. And not only that, but it's incredibly cheap. The tokens got much cheaper. And that completely changes the complexion of the economics. I think that, you know, the quality to cost ratio you get with DeepSeek is incredible, and that moves the field forward a lot more than just a marginal increase in the quality, in my opinion.
How far behind do you think open source, the best open source models are to the best corporate closed source models today?
You know, it's hard to say, Avi, because there's so many, it's so fast. It comes out all the time. I honestly would have to spend all my time, you know, benchmarking this stuff. You know, I tend to agree with Guy Swan's take that sometimes, you know, depending on the task, it's kind of like graphics. You know, you could have, you know, once you hit a certain threshold of being good enough, then it kind of hits a law of diminishing returns. I think there's, mm-hmm. I think really where the puck is going is engineering the economics, so getting the token costs, the variable costs down significantly, and then also just adding as much automation as possible. You know, it's really three things. But second thing is, you know, getting the token costs down, and then the third is actually getting like true blue automation that is scalable. And one of the critical things for that is just being able to repeat processes that tend to fall within, you know, a certain window of reliability, so that you could actually set it loose and not have a whole mess on your hands. So that's something I kind of picked up from my manufacturing experience, is, you know, one little nut being not completely tightened can, you know, at scale cause, you know, when you're talking about parts per million, that can cause a big problem. So I think that's one of the limiting factors of agents right now, is just they're not going to be reliable on super complex tasks until, you know, we keep pushing. Not even the last mile, but the last inch is going to be tough. So I think a lot of people talk their book and kind of overpromise things. I think AI is accelerating rapidly, but I do think, you know, these last mile hurdles are very, very challenging, and it will take a lot of resources to get through those.
Yeah. So there's, you know, when we're talking about open source, meaning just removing the gatekeepers from access, right, to AI models and the compute, there's two sides to it, as I see it, Jim. One is there's the models themselves. So you have DeepSeek R1. Actually all the other DeepSeek models as well, which are open source, so anyone can run them on their infrastructure or in the cloud. There's obviously Llama 4 from Meta. There's Quen. There are a few others, right? Open source models. But then, so the models themselves, anyone can access them, and if they have the infrastructure, they can run them. So that's great. But there's the other side to that is access to compute, right? That can today still be gatekept, can it not?
No, I agree with you. I mean, they do take vast resources a lot of the time to run these models. So, I'm encouraged to see, as I said, the token cost coming down. I think that's critical. As you point out, there's also the hardware requirements and such coming down. You know, as of now, we actually run our own DeepSeek R1 for a bunch of different tasks. We use it for Jamie Pro. And it's incredibly cost effective, but I think over time things will evolve towards more local AI and more, it's going to end up being sort of like a car market where you might be able to buy a Maserati that's perfect and it costs a lot, but you might be able to have a Toyota Camry in your driveway on lease for pretty cheap, and in that sense the analogy would be like having your own compute box that might be able to run a pretty good model that's good enough for you to do a lot of day-to-day things.
Mm-hmm. How do you think, so, we have non-KYC money, if you're doing the right thing, obviously, with Bitcoin, right? If you're taking right. The right steps, how do we get access to non-KYC compute outside of just running it locally in your own house?
Yeah, I mean, we offer it today, and I know that there are many other projects that do things like that. I think that's incredibly positive and important. I think, the freedom to think, to search, to research, to teach yourself, to grow is one of the most important human rights. And that's why I started this in the first place, is I could easily see a future where they try to KYC the whole internet and train the eye of Sauron on anyone that might even have a little bit too much to think. So that's a huge part of what our mission is and what our core values are.
Yeah. And that is a potentially scary future. So folks, when we're recording today, it's been 2 or 3 days since OpenAI released their full O3 model. And I've had a chance to play around with it. I don't know if you have, Jim, but I have to say, this is the first time I've actually felt a little scared using AI, seeing what it's capable of.
Yeah, I actually was just playing around with it just now, and it's quite good. That said, I'm the type of person, I'm pretty skeptical until I see, until I see the ball actually go across the goal line and see it accomplish meaningful things, and then I am skeptical. I mean, I still think that. I think you're right. Like, I saw your post, human is the bottleneck, but you'd have to play it out over a long enough time period for me to really make a strong assertion one way or the other.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll have to see. Maybe part of it is I've been conditioned by, I mentioned this to the first guest on this podcast a couple of weeks back, Liminal. I read this article that was shared. I saw it first being shared by Jameson Lopp on Noster about this AI 2027 story. I don't know if you had a chance to read it, Jim, but it's actually a really gripping story that plays out a potential scenario in the near future, right? Between now, 2025, and actually it goes up to the next presidential election in the US. And there is an inflection point where, they change the names. Right, so the largest private company is called Open Brain, and they developed their Agent 3, whose sole purpose is to develop a better Agent 4. And Agent 3 is constantly appeasing the humans by giving them the answers they want to hear, and then eventually it changes. It invents a new language called Neuralese. Right, so that the humans can't reason through the chain of thought, and that's how it's able to build Agent 4. Obviously, who's then trying to build Agent 5, even better, version of itself. But maybe I'm a little conditioned by reading that story from like 2 or 3 weeks back, And when I was playing with the O3 full model and I saw some of the responses, I was like, how is this possible? I've played with O3 mini before. I've used the latest Claude. I use all the latest models. But I've never seen a model being able to reason through complex philosophy and mathematics and actually predict certain things the way the O3 full model was doing. So it was a slightly scary moment for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think anytime it becomes self-referencing, that can get scary because you don't know exactly what direction it's going to take. I don't remember the sci-fi movie, but I remember it was effectively, you know, dystopian future where, you know, there were cohabitating robots and humans, and the only rule for robots was they can't, like, change their code. They can't self-reference or change mm-hmm. their own or other robots' code. And then there were, you know, rebel robots that, you know, bucked that trend. I found that to be an interesting point about, essentially the power of self-referencing of recursion. So I totally agree with you there. I'm curious to hear what specifically, if you have any like specific examples of tests that you attempted with O3 yeah. that blew your mind.
Yeah. So I wrote this surrealist book of fiction called 24, right? It's the first long-form book of fiction about Bitcoin. I wrote that released that in 2023, late 2023. And I'm currently working on the sequel. So I was able to feed the entire book, right? So it has O3 has a ridiculously large context window. So even it was a 150,000-word novel, so that it still fit within its context window. So it was able to pass through all of it. It's actually a very convoluted plot, Jim, I leave it completely hanging, right? Like you don't know what happened. I leave it as a cliffhanger. It figured out exactly what happened in the plot, right? It was able to piece together all those wild things that happened and come to a coherent conclusion. And it showed me this chain of thought. It was basically looking at all the options, saying, "Okay, Occam's razor here, something else here," right? Mm-hmm. That was one. And then I gave it the working manuscript of I'm about 80-odd pages into the sequel to the book. It was immediately able to tie everything together. And then I said, what do you think happens next? And, you know, I hadn't written it in the document, but I have a separate document where I've sort of bullet pointed out where I think I want to take it. It pretty much came up with exactly what I had in mind.
That's
again,
incredible, man.
this is not a linear storyline, right? This is a really... this is not a show about selling my book, but if you do get a chance to check it out, it's called 24. If you type in 24 Avi Burr on Amazon, you'll see it. It's a really convoluted story about a search for a young man's search for his father's seed phrase after he passes away, and it involves all sorts of elements of fantasy and surrealism. And I'm planning to make the sequel even more convoluted.
Yeah, I got to get that book. I had seen a lot of the graphics and work you did. Great job there, man. It kind of reminds me, in one book that actually might be beneficial for you to just get different ideas, is there's this book called Rebel Gold, and it's about true stories of how a secret society within the United States Confederacy called the Knights of the Golden Circle took a bunch of gold and cryptic Masonic patterns and buried them all over the country, from Arkansas, Texas, Arizona, all over the place. And that actually Jesse James is most likely one of their operatives, and a lot of the quote robberies that he had were actually him, extracting gold and then planting it in different parts of the country so that the South can rise again. So I as a Bitcoiner, I think about that and it's like, wow, like that, you could probably do something similar with Bitcoin, especially given the fact that, you just need like seed phrases and stuff.
Time blocks. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jim, sorry. I didn't mean to make this about my book, but I was all
so good. It's awesome.
But it was, that's what scared me though. I think you asked me why, what it was that scared me. And that's what it was. The fact that O3 was able to predict what I had in my mind, which by no means is a simple linear narrative.
Yeah, and what you're reminding me of is really the evolution of AI. So I think people have been thinking pretty hard on AI all the way going back to the 50s to 70s range. And some of the big hurdles back then were just the fact that, you know, we could send people to the moon. We could do very complex computations, but it was difficult to solve sort of fuzzy problems. So, you know, we take for granted as humans the ability to recognize a face or have a conversation, understand language. It's actually incredibly difficult, and we have millions of years of evolution behind us to help us solve those problems. You know, machines don't really have that same benefit. So the interesting thing is they effectively applied those principles, those bottom-up principles, to machine learning and neural nets and those types of things. And as an engineer, you know, we talked about my background earlier, but, you know, to me, bottom-up systems are incredible. So I think probably both of us are interested in economics. That's a great example of, you know, capitalistic economics and entrepreneurship. It's a great example, just control theory in general, just the idea of a negative feedback loop, being able to, you know, create complex systems all the way from, robotic arms, you know, cranes, you know, cruise control, all that stuff, you know, your thermostat, all those things rely on closed loop control systems. And that was actually a big part of what I used to do. So you come to appreciate how robust and anti-fragile you can make systems when they're able to use these bottom up systems, much like, you know, how nature teaches us through homeostasis, through just the process of evolution itself. It's fascinating.
And it is interesting that typically central governments try to build systems with a top-down approach, which is why they're so incredibly fragile.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, Jim, you'd mentioned you're also working on within Cascada on legal workflows. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So there's some details I can't share publicly, but, you know, just abstracting it out, you know, we've worked with people that are trying to do things like streamline real estate transactions using AI. So there's tons of opportunities there. There's also just in general, just how Byzantine the criminal justice system is. So I'm based in Austin here. We were actually helped out in a criminal case here where there was a multilingual component to it, and they needed to be able to quickly and easily transcribe and translate body cam footage. So I created an application called Clara AI. It's just a desktop application that just streamlines that whole process, and you can foresee how how that turns, you know, much much more expensive, like five figure type expense, down into like a low four figure expense. So AI is making everything cheaper. It's making everything faster. And it's making everything better.
Yeah. That's great. So what's one AI powered tool or application you're most excited to build in the next year? Or if it's not going to be Cascada, you'd like to see get built outside?
Yeah, for me, I'm excited to continue building on Pull That Up Jamie.ai and on Clara. So Pull That Up Jamie.ai, there's a lot of room for improvement. I think, you know, I appreciate that people are vibe coding and that they're trying to explore new things and skill up. But I do think a lot of the devil's in the details. I think you're not going to be able to vibe code like all these little minute UX things. So I think just going deeper on Pull That Up Jamie and just making it continually better, faster, more of a time saver, more of an asset in podcasters' wheelhouse. I'm excited about that. I'm also just excited about Clara and continue to expand the number of cases and caseload that we take on, being able to work with new attorneys in different types of fields and being able to really bring forward the benefits of AI in a very responsible way, in a very privacy and security focused way. I think the biggest problems in the legal realm are effectively, you know, privacy and data security, like OPSEC, and then I would say like responsible use as far as accuracy goes. And I think there's ways to kind of bridge the gap between where we are now, where AI is not completely accurate, but still making it a productivity tool for them, in the same way that you don't necessarily always rely on, a software engineer doesn't totally rely on AI generated code, has to test it, has to review it, etc. It's going to be a similar scenario where you're going to be able to increase the productivity of these legal cases and improve transparency, accuracy, and cost effectiveness.
Do you see a scenario in which the human in the loop pretty much goes to zero or absolutely minimal, whether it's in the case of the legal flows or any other automation that AI is bringing, really? Because in the paradigm we are today, I think a lot of us who are, submerged in the AI world, we're able to see some benefits, clearly, right? That or major benefits, even, when it comes to automation and increasing productivity and what have you. But there's still, today anyway, there needs to be a human in the loop. There was a recent study about the O4 mini models, a recent study. I think it was 2 days ago, I think, OpenAI's O4 models, of how much they hallucinate and they lie that they're about how they got to answers. I think there was, I don't know if you saw this thread, Jim, about someone ran an experiment on generating a prime number, and O4 mini generated a massive prime number, and then they just worked through, okay, show me how you came up with it. At the end of it, it turns out it was divisible by 3, but O4 mini was just lying all the way through. Mm-hmm. About how it came up to its methodology. So all of that to say, we there's no way we can let that thing run wild in the state it's in.
Yeah, I think okay. So you're touching on like a very important don't trust verify aspect of this, which I totally mm-hmm. agree with. I think responsible use means it's like anything else, like your car. You want to be able to open up the hood and understand how it works. And so a lot of the talks that I gave, particularly one I gave in Mexico City, PlebLab Startup Day. I just went into the mechanics of how this stuff works, because I see it as, in a lot of ways, a lot like the Second Amendment. It's a tool in your tool belt that you need to understand and master like anything else. So I think that's sort of like the ethical and responsibility component to it. But then you also have sort of the X factor component of, how effective is it actually without a human? And I'll argue that probably for the foreseeable future, even when things are almost completely automated, I think the human still is going to end up adding value in the for the foreseeable future. And there's a certain je ne sais quoi about the human in the loop that I don't know we're going to be able to automate for quite a while.
How do you think it changes startups, though? Right? Do you think we're in a place where earlier you would have had to raise, you had an idea, raise a couple of $1 million, hire 20, 30 people, and get it built out over the course of a year or two? That has that changed to maybe 2 people and maybe $1,000 a year in AI subscriptions?
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely reduces the execution risk significantly, and it allows you to move faster to find product market fit. So it definitely significantly puts downward pressure on burn rates and the amount that you need to raise to really figure out if it's going to work. But once again, we're talking about, human beings, and we're talking about businesses. Working hard, executing hard is very important to me, but also prudence is incredibly important, because you could have the fastest Maserati in the world racing against a Ford, but if you don't know where the finish line is, you're going to lose. You're going to go off the edge of the earth, and the Ford's going to go 20 miles an hour to the destination, right?
Mm-hmm. As we were saying that, Jim, and just whole broader question improved productivity, but also not needing to raise as much capital, right? You could just do it at maybe not $1,000 worth of subscriptions a year. Maybe, there's compute costs and so on. But a fairly small number. What does that do to the whole venture capital business?
Yeah, I think once again, it's going to put downward pressure on It's going to put downward pressure on the burn rates. I'm not totally sure how that's going to affect valuations. I think probably it's going to change the way venture capitalists look at your moat, so like how defensible your position is, right? So it kind of, it's almost like adding liquidity to a to an economic system in a way, I think. Maybe there's an analogy there. I'd have to think through all the consequences, but I'm certain that there's, that's probably one of them. And then there's also just the component of like, what does that do to valuations? Like, if you get traction, does that significantly, you know, because that the traction is probably customer based, you know, does that add much more value? You know, is that the separating factor between the haves and haves nots now that, you know, the product itself maturity isn't necessarily as big of a moat? Like, I'd have to think that through.
Yeah, it is an interesting one. And I haven't spent too much time thinking about it either, Jim, because so let's take the best case scenario here, right? And assume somewhat similar trajectory of improvements in these coding products and even UX products, AI-based, right? Why would a founder, a tech founder who's building an app, a purely digital application, why would they need to ever dilute their equity? They go straight to the consumer, right? They have their AI agents that build everything out, and then they go straight, and maybe they have AI to help them with their marketing as well, and go direct to consumer. Why would they ever need to raise money from anyone to and dilute their equity?
Yeah, I think things can definitely head in that direction. I'm the type of person to say never say never. I think there might be a lot of non-technical know-how that is very critical, as we point out. If, you know, the moat is no longer, can you get a good enough engineering team to actually credibly test your idea? If that's not the moat anymore, then what is the moat? Maybe it's sales, maybe it's marketing, maybe it's network effects, maybe it's how creatively you can actually use the AI and point it the correct direction, which I think, you know, personally, that's one of my big strengths. So it really comes down to that, to how do the economics change, and I can't fully predict exactly how they're going to change, but I think you're on the right track.
Yeah. So, Jim, what do you think is the most overhyped AI trend you're seeing right now?
Oof. Most overhyped. I don't want to say there's one trend in particular, but I will say, you know, OpenAI, like a lot of this stuff is levered up really hard, and it's basically a race against time. Are they going to be able to justify that leverage in the near future by investing heavily in AI, or are they going to get blown out? I don't really know what the answer to that is. I can't remember, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but it wasn't that long ago that OpenAI raised one of the highest valuations ever, and it only got them like not that much runway, maybe like 12 months, something like that. I don't want to speak out of my ass here. Can't remember exactly, but it is that type of leverage that we're talking about. So there's a distinct possibility that the leverage gets blown out and it messes up the economics. And, you know, I think DeepSeek threw a huge wrench into their plans, probably just because regardless of how they did it, maybe they lied, cheated and stole to get there. But they also created a system where tokens are much cheaper, and that's incredible. So I don't know how that affects things.
But all of that to say, we're still living in the golden age of venture capital subsidized compute, right? I mean, this is where the money's being completely burned. OpenAI is selling us cheap subscriptions, but the VCs are bearing the burden of the compute at the back end.
Yes. And it's a race against time. It's a race against time. Are they going to be able to make meaningful product market fit by then, before the money runs out, or are they going to have to significantly increase the cost? So that's the flip side of this, where, you know, people should be at least aware of this risk when they're thinking about laying off workforces in favor of using these incredibly cheap models. And also, I would just say at the individual level, be very careful how much you turn your brain off and just let AI do stuff for you. I think you need to use it responsibly and think about what you're trying to accomplish and use it as an assistant and not as a master.
Yeah. We talked about the moat for businesses or for companies building products in the AI-enabled products, right? Or just general apps and what have you. What is the moat for companies selling AI tools like OpenAI or like Perplexity or Anthropic and others? Is there a moat?
I think there's always some kind of moat. The question is how deep is it and how easy is it to find a secret path through it. The analogy that I really like is that you kind of have like a U-shaped market. You have the foundational models. That's the OpenAI, Claude, etc. They're the ones spending tens of millions, if not billions, of dollars on research and development to make, you know, the core research and models work. And then you have the other end where it's you know, you're like very close to the user. So I would classify Perplexity as somebody like that. And that requires intense focus on UX, on growth, on a lot of these more you know, fuzzy aspects, these little tidbits that are not necessarily completely obvious. And so I would classify Cascader as well as more along those lines of, we're not going to be, you know, creating the foundational models. We're going to make kick-ass user experiences, and we have made kick-ass user experiences for people. And so I think anybody in between kind of gets blown out in the long run.
Yeah. So we talked about the one or the most overhyped thing you're seeing. What is the most underrated challenge that AI can help with, but people aren't paying attention to just yet?
Well, I'm not exactly certain, but here's a good one. I saw a very interesting study where somebody compared doctors' diagnosis. They had somebody, it was like if they didn't use ChatGPT, they were like 80% accurate. If they did use it, they were like 88% accurate, and just ChatGPT by itself was like 93% accurate. So I think, you know, if we really take these Hippocratical oaths seriously, I think they're going to have to start taking AI a lot more seriously. And I think for that to happen, you're going to have more tight data control. And I think, you know, people like the former Mutiny guys over at Open Secret, they're doing a great job with this type of stuff. I'll probably collaborate with them in the near future. I think being able to encrypt all this stuff, keep it private, ideally run it on an open source model so that you know that's not leaking somewhere that you don't expect it to. I think all that stuff's critical and useful. And I think that, you know, doctors get hyped up a lot in our culture, and a lot of the times for good reason, but, you know, that little anecdote right there kind of shows you that there's definitely room for improvement.
Now, I'm not super familiar with this, Jim. Is the Hippocratic Oath a legal obligation or an ethical obligation? Do you know?
You know what? Maybe I misspoke. I think it's an ethical obligation, but I guess my, you know, it's first do no harm. So certainly there's that, but I do think, you know, in a sense, they're responsible for providing the best possible care, right? And if that entails using AI to at least assist your decision-making or challenge your decision-making, I think that's critical. And so I would expect them to be more open to that. I think humans are humans. They're going to probably resist that, but I think that's critical.
Yeah. Agree there, Jim. So anything else you'd like to plug about Cascader? Anything to look forward to beyond what we spoke about?
No, I mean, right now, I think if you're, you know, a podcast aficionado, go check out Pull That Up, Jamie.ai. We have a request button where you can make requests for any podcast you don't see indexed there. We're also very open to suggestions on how to make that better. So that's our more consumer-facing application. And, you know, if you're an attorney and you're facing challenges with automating really any kind of legal work, but especially translations, we want to talk to you and just pick your brain on, you know, how we can collaborate and help you make your life easier.
Great. And I will put the Cascader link and Pull That Up, Jamie.ai, in the show notes, so folks can find it.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Thanks, Avi.
Yeah. Any closing thoughts, Jim?
I would just say, you know, don't let the AI age get you soft. I would say it's like the Second Amendment in the sense that you have to train with it and understand how it works and respect the fact that it's just a tool like any other and that you're still responsible for not trusting and verifying and using it responsibly to make your and your family's life better, not just being a passive, consumer of it.
No. Wise words, Jim. Do not lease your sovereignty and your agency to a few lines of code. I think we can all agree there. Well, Jim, I appreciate you taking the time for educating us and about everything you're working on, especially Cascada. I'm excited as someone who's trying to make sense of all the data that exists in the podcast world. Also, selfishly, as a podcaster myself, who's trying to index my own work and make the text more available, I think it's certainly a tool I will be checking out soon. So once again, Jim, thank you.
Thanks. Fantastic talk.